UK Wine Show, show number 109. Sam Harrop on Wine Making Faults and Brett Meissen. On this week's show, we cast the spotlight into our book review, Great Britain. Sam Harrop finishes up an in-depth look at wine faults, focusing on Brettanomyces.
And in the news, Tuscan wine under investigation, winery goes carbon neutral, and wine could cut risk of arthritis.
G'day. Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 109 for the 13th of June, 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show, we wrap up our look at wine faults. We finish up with talking with Sam Harrop about Brettanomyces. We also announce this month's poll, and we test how many units in a bottle of wine. And finally, we review David Harvey's book, Great Britain. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. Vino Nobile di Montepulciano has become the second Tuscan wine to come under investigation for allegedly having grapes illegally blended into it from outside the region. According to Italian media reports, 120,000 hectolitres of Vino Nobile have been confiscated from the Vecchia Cantina cooperative, and another company is also under investigation. This follows 2 months of speculation about Brunello di Montalcino, the wine the US are threatening to ban after claims that some of it has been blended with cheaper grapes from the south. This wine, which is made from the Sangiovese grape, is perhaps Italy's finest, and US exports account for a quarter of sales. The ban has been postponed until the 23rd of June to allow time to find a solution.
Thanks, Jane. This story's been dragging on and on and on, and it does look that through all the smoke, there is some fire. Some wineries have been caught producing wine in well in excess of their legal limits given the yield restrictions and the acreage that they own. And while it's all denied to be tied in, the chairman of Brunello Corsesso has resigned this week after completing only one of a three-year term, saying that his work's been done. Apparently he feels that a new decree by the Italian Minister of Agriculture will guarantee the authenticity of Brunello. But given he's overseen a complete opposite that's come about, it's not surprising he's resigned after claiming he's done his job after one-third of a three-year term. What's up next, Jane?
Well, next up we're over to squeaky clean New Zealand, where a third winery has been accredited with Carbon Zero certification, the country's programme for organisations that reduce and offset their emissions. Phil and Chris Rose, the owners of Wairau River Wines, have just completed their 30th vintage. And with five children involved in the business and with five grandchildren, they have good reason to be looking towards a sustainable future. Assessing the emissions at Wairau River is made easier because the company controls all parts of the winemaking process, from vine to bottle. And some of their initiatives to reduce emissions include eliminating the use of helicopters for frost protection, reducing the weight of bottles, and using smaller and lighter cartons for packaging. Any remaining carbon emissions will then be offset through the New Zealand government's wind power projects. New Zealand led the way in carbon neutrality for wineries, with Grove Mill, another Marlborough-based company, becoming the first ever carbon neutral winery. This was followed by South Australia's Elderton Wines, and then Baxberg Estate in South Africa. Since then, a few more have popped up in the New World, and even in the Old World, one of the most traditional regions, Bordeaux, is joining in, with a couple of wineries there already working towards carbon neutral status. Chris?
Well, in a previous life, I used to work as a power systems engineer for Meridian Energy in New Zealand, one of the companies that are providing those wind power credits that Wairau River are purchasing. And unlike so many carbon credits, such as planting forests, which I personally can't stand, these do look like high-quality credits, replacing coal and gas power with wind energy. I'm so pleased that Wairau is going carbon green, as they produce an absolutely gorgeous Pinot Gris and a not-too-shabby Pinot Noir. But as the article said, other countries are getting in on the act. So while there is a lack of international agreement on what is a carbon zero or carbon neutral for a winery, it looks like these early trailblazers are simply getting on with the job. What's the final story this week, Jane?
Well, my last story this week, Chris, is news that drinking wine can cut the risk of developing arthritis. According to new scientific research, drinking five or more glasses a week can cut the risk of developing rheumatoid arthritis by up to 50%. The results of the study by the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm showed that drinking alcohol was associated with a significantly lower risk of developing arthritis, a degenerative inflammatory disorder that's characterized by swelling of the joints, muscle weakness, and fatigue. It also showed that the more alcohol consumed, the lower the risk of developing the disease. Although more work's needed to explain the link, it's thought that alcohol suppresses the immune system and damps down the inflammatory process behind the condition. However, Professor Robert Mootz for the Arthritis Research Campaign warned that the risks of drinking too much alcohol by far outweigh any potential benefit for reducing the risk of arthritis. Researchers said the findings were in those with the early signs of the disease, and they could not recommend existing sufferers start drinking to alleviate their symptoms. That's all from me this week, but don't forget you can get more detail on any of these news stories at our website www.3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. There's been a lot of talk about binge drinking in the press recently, but there's such a weight of evidence looking at the health effects of wine that it's hard to ignore that a glass of wine a day is actually quite helpful for your health. So, when you're listening to all the talk about alcohol, remember that wine is a social lubricant, a medicine, and a poison. It's all about the dosage. Dosage is a great word, and it's related to this month's poll. Over the last couple of weeks in the UK, the Department of Health has been running an advertising campaign explaining the number of units that different drinks have. This month's poll is to find out, has the information sunk in? So, the question is this month, how many units in a 250ml glass of wine? Is it 1, 2, 3, or 4? Now, I'm not looking for you to go on the internet, look up the answer and give me that. I want to know what you think off the top of your head, and I'll give you a breakdown of all this information at the end of the month. Next up, we have the book review with David Harvey, Great Britain, a tour of Britain's vineyards. David Harvey is the first person to release a new book on English and Welsh wine in quite some time. Until now, the only book I've had that lists English vineyards has been Stephen Skelton's rather thick and hard to wade through first edition, Wines of Britain and Ireland, which was published way back in 2001. Over 7 years ago. So, it was great excitement. I initially flicked through the book, and it looked good, with lots of coloured pictures and generally quite accessible text. I was a bit disappointed that, as I just got the book within a couple of weeks of being released, it was already out of date by over a year. For example, Dermot Sugrue, the ex-winemaker I interviewed a couple of years ago, back in show number 2, was interviewed by David as well, probably around the same time. But Dermot has not been the winemaker at Nye Timber for over a year. So I was a bit disappointed to see that David's newly published book is already over a year out of date. Writing must have stopped sometime around April 2007, where he describes one of the wettest summers in a long time as, at the beginning of April 2007, a hot summer was predicted. How wrong was he? However, ignoring that the book is a wee bit out of date at going to print, the write-ups of the people in David's book are honest and at times quite playful. I think he's managed to capture the spirit of the people, and with quite an accessible language. I like his style of writing, it's certainly nice, and a bit more engaging than most of the other English wine books, but I do find it hard to work out where this book fits in. It isn't a full-on reference book, but it would certainly be useful to English wine enthusiasts. It isn't really a great coffee book either. It doesn't have the sort of high-quality pictures that you normally expect with coffee books. And there is a lack of maps, and it assumes that the reader has a really good working knowledge of English counties and locations. Perhaps an overview of England and soils or climate would also be helpful, along with maybe an introduction to each county. All in all, David's managed to write a clear book that's both readable to most people and with enough interesting anecdotes to keep everybody happy. It's certainly not a reference book, but neither can it really be read cover to cover. Perhaps a coffee book is its best location. In the end, I gave it 3 out of 5. That ends this week's Spotlight. In the Spotlight next week, we're going to be starting to look at wine and health. Now, while drinking faulty wine is not usually unhealthy, it certainly is not much fun. In this week's final interview, we talk with Sam Harrop, IWC faults expert and co-chairman of the International Wine Challenge. We talk with Sam about wine faults, and in particular, Brettanomyces, the yeast that won't go away. Let's have a listen to what Sam has to say. Hi, I'm here with Sam Harrop. You're the co-chairman at the IWC. You're also in charge of the faults. And what I want to talk about this week is something that a lot of people really don't understand. It's a fault called Brett or Brettanomyces.
So I'm really happy to be here. Thank you very much for asking me to talk. Brettanomyces, a fascinating area. I wrote my dissertation, my Masters of Wine dissertation on Brettanomyces years ago on the basis that in coming to the UK, I found so many wine experts with dandruff on their sort of collar and, you know, dust on their overcoats, loving this animal character, this animal flavour, this farmyard, earthy character, which at university I'd been told by my professors was a fault. It was clearly Brettanomyces. And so I came to the UK observing this, thinking, this is rather odd, how can they like it, you know? And it just got, I got fascinated in Brett from that point because, you know, I've understood from a very early time in my career that in the wine industry, no one is right, no one is wrong. When you're judging, no one is right, no one is wrong. It's the group consensus that is all important, you know. And it's a subjective thing, wine tasting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so, you know, these experts who in the UK, or around the world for that matter, who like Brett are entitled to like Brett. They really are. Equally, those who don't like it are entitled to that judgment. So that got me fascinated. I wanted to just sort of dig in there a bit further, and so I decided to do my dissertation on Brett.
So what is Brett?
Brett is, or Brettanomyces, as it's known, is a yeast, a rogue yeast, wild yeast, whatever you want to call it. But it's a yeast that is very, very tolerant to sulfur dioxide. It's also very tolerant to alcohol. Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is the yeast used by most winemakers throughout the entire winemaking or fermentation process, is a yeast that's not very tolerant to alcohol and it's not very tolerant to sulfur dioxide. So it once it's finished its fermentation to dryness, it will effectively not flourish again after bottling, for example, even if there's a little bit of residual sugar, because it's not very tolerant to alcohol. So Saccharomyces cerevisiae is a strong yeast that is used globally. It's the yeast of choice for inoculation. It's not tolerant to high alcohols. It's not tolerant to high sulfur. Brettanomyces is tolerant, as I said earlier. And so after fermentation, Brettanomyces can survive in this hostile environment effectively.
Yep.
And just very gradually eat away at the residual sugar levels in the wine, whether it be red or white. Obviously, it's more common in red wine.
Yep.
So what it does, it effectively eats away slowly, whether it be in barrel or tank or in bottle, if the environment is right, and it produces these volatile phenols, among other compounds. The volatile phenols are the compounds that, you know, I'm interested in most, because these are the compounds that I discussed before, the animal compounds, you know, and that people either love or hate.
Yep.
There's two types of volatile phenols that Brettanomyces produces. There's the 4-ethyl phenol, and there's the 4-ethyl guaiacol. Yep. The 4-ethyl phenol, which is the most common character you find with Brettanomyces, is the farmyard, the animal character.
When people talk about farmyard, I always think it's sort of a manurey smell.
That's one. In extreme levels, it can really manifest itself as a manure character. 4-ethyl guaiacol is the clove character, or the smoky character.
Oh, okay.
Which actually I tend to think can be a little more attractive in certain wine styles than perhaps, for my taste, than perhaps the manure character.
How can you separate, like, a lot of wines that have a smokiness, I always associate with maybe the toastiness of the barrel beforehand?
Yeah, that's a really good point, and it's very difficult to separate the different characters. And one of the things I've found during my dissertation and over the years is that with Brettanomyces comes volatile phenols, but also you get all these other compounds, and one of those is these sulfide compounds that I keep on coming back to that can manifest themselves in a smoky manner as well. A matchstick, burnt matchstick sort of character, you know. But all sorts of sulfide expressions from Britannomyces. You know, there's the eggy character. There's the, I like to use this descriptor, Pavlova, being a good Kiwi. Well, not that good because I've been living in England for the last 10 years. But, you know, Pavlova, which is the meringue-like character. So it's a sweet, eggy dessert quality, which in excess can be, for me, a terrible thing. But if it's balanced with good, fresh fruit, it can be a wonderful thing. So these compounds can also come with volatile phenols because Britannomyces, as it's working on that small amount of residual sugar, is producing sulfides, you know, just like Saccharomyces cerevisiae does when the nutrient levels are not to its liking, it produces sulfides. And Britannomyces does that as well. So that's why it's very difficult to separate volatile phenols from sulfides. They're similar in many ways, but they also come together with the activity of the Britannomyces.
Is leather a Brit smell?
Yeah, leather for sure. That's actually, for me, an extreme sort of almost tertiary development of some of these volatile phenol characters, in particular the ethyl group. So, that's a, you know, horse saddle. Sweaty saddle is also another character that's used to describe Britannomyces. Now, you find these in certain wine styles for sure. And so I did my dissertation on Syrah.
Yep.
Britannomyces and the impact on wine quality for Syrah-based blends. Now, the reason I chose Syrah, coming back to your point about smoky sulfides and all that, is because Syrah is a very reductive variety.
Yep.
And I was amazed that in the Rhone Valley in particular, you know, you get these Chateauneuf de Papes or Cote Rôties or Vacherais, or to a lesser extent Vacherais, because there's a lot more Grenache there actually. But in these wine styles that have a component of Syrah in the blend, quite often they show these smoky farmyard characters, you know. And I was trying to understand, firstly, do people like this character? If they like it, what level do they like it? In addition, how much of these characters are being perceived as volatile phenols are actually sulfides due to the reductive nature of the Syrah varietal. You know, so it's all intertwined and it's difficult to understand. And there's still a lot more to be understood in this area.
See, a lot of the smells that you're describing, I normally associate with an aging characteristic with the wine.
Mm.
Is that true? Does it develop over time? Or is it something that the Brett's bubbling away in the wine producing these aromas, or is it a case that they're precursors that Brett creates and then they develop in the bottle afterwards?
Okay, let's get one thing clear from the outset, is that in my research, and I've now, well, it's not huge research, but I've analysed over 50 red wines, Syrah-based wines, for levels of volatile phenols. Now, these are top Syrahs from around the world. All but one of them, so 49 out of 50, showed levels of volatile phenols, which indicates that the vast majority of red wines have, at some stage in their life, whether it's during alavage or after bottling, have had Britannomyces activity. Okay,
is this European wines or
no? From all over, all over. Yeah, Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, you know, and the reason being is because the reason for this is that red wines produce a wonderful environment for Britannomyces activity. You know, as I said before, Britannomyces don't need a great deal of residual sugar to function effectively, and normally in red wine there is a certain level of sugar after fermentation, not huge amounts, but enough. And white wines, also, you might note that pHs are generally lower. I haven't mentioned that Britannomyces prefer a higher pH.
So it's less acidity.
Absolutely. And at higher pHs, sulfur dioxide, which can be used to control Britannomyces, is less effective at higher pHs, I should say. So this is a reason why you know, Britannomyces thrives better in red wine. The other factor, and an important one, is that red wine is, generally speaking, stored in oak, certainly these premium styles.
Yep.
And in oak, there is it's a great environment for the success of Brettanomyces. You often find on the barrel, on the inside of the barrel, a good healthy population of Brett. Now, one of the reasons for this is because there's actually sugar
in the barrels.
Yeah, and,
sure.
You know, one of the big misunderstandings I found in my research is that winemakers around the world will say, ah, okay, I've got Brett in my barrels. They're old barrels. I'm going to throw my old barrels away because it's a greater risk, and I'm going to buy new barrels, you know, because that's less of a risk. Actually, you know, if you keep your barrels clean, old barrels are less of a risk than new barrels because old barrels have less sugar for the Brettanomyces to feed on. So new barrels are actually a higher risk vessel for Brettanomyces activity. One of the big issues, I think, for super premium red wines around the world now that are choosing to use lower sulfur to get more fruit expression, higher pH and higher sugars to get more ripeness and
fatness
and softer, supple textures, and other winemaking techniques they choose to employ. One of the big risks is that Brettanomyces, they're creating an environment for Brettanomyces to flourish. You know, as I said earlier, Brettanomyces likes high pH because of the relationship with sulfur. They like low sulfur, although they are quite tolerant to sulfur, they can still hurt them, you know. They like residual sugar. Now, if you're picking at 15, 16 Beaumé, it's going to be very hard to get that ferment to complete dryness. There's going to be quite a bit of residual sugar left. Even if, you know, the general consumer can't pick it up, there will be high levels for Brettanomyces. So you're creating, and also the new oak component, you know. Nowadays, it's not uncommon for top producers to store their wonderful premium cuvée in 100% new oak for 18 months. You know, wonderful environment for Brettanomyces if the sulfur levels are not being managed. So I think Brettanomyces is on the rise, a bit like our discussion the other day with reduction on the rise in the new world. It's a serious issue that winemakers need to get hold of.
Do you think Brett is a good thing or bad thing in general? Because obviously complexity in a wine, I think, is a good thing. But you know, what's your opinion on that?
I have a personal opinion, which isn't really valid, to be honest, but I'll tell you my personal opinion is I like a little bit of volatile phenols, as long as there's good fruit and as long as it's the right style. You know, I mean, let's talk about Gamay, for instance. I don't think there's a place for any volatile phenols in Gamay. You know, that Prima maceration carbonic style. It's all about fruit.
Yeah, yeah. Bubblegum.
And there's absolutely, yeah. And there's certainly no place for Brett in white wines of any description, I think. That's a disaster. But in certain red wine styles, like Syrah, Cabernet Merlot, a little bit in Grenache, you know, the classics. Look at Bordeaux. The great wines of Bordeaux that have created this incredible industry, en primeur industry, have traditionally had good levels of, you know, quite significant levels of Brettanomyces, or volatile phenols, I should say. And, you know, so there's definitely a market for it. I like a little bit of volatile phenol in those styles, but not too much. I think if it dominates, it's a disaster. And this leads me to the critical point, because winemakers in Australia and New Zealand will be cringing right now at hearing this, because they're obsessed with stability, and rightly so. You know, consumers should know that when they buy that bottle of wine, that it's not going to, there's not going to be a fermentation going on in bottle. What they buy is what they should get. You know, there should be a stable product over time. If they want to store the wine, it should be stable. There shouldn't be any microbial activity. So this is one of the big issues with Brett. You know, where has the volatile phenol compound come from in that Cabernet Sauvignon blend?
Has it come from the bottle?
From alavage, or has it come from bottle?
Alavage is
storage in vessel before bottling. So that's the big unknown, and that's one of the reasons why the Australians in particular are stamping out Brett. They're doing everything they can to educate their producers to monitor the wine during alavage and to control with adequate levels of sulfur and to filter at bottling.
I was going to say, does filter take out Brett? Because Brett,
for sure,
yeast is a big molecule and you should be able to take it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Although Brett can actually fit through a 0.45 micron filter, membrane filter, believe it or not, if it goes through sideways. Okay? Because it's quite thin, you know. Yeah. It's like the one of these supermodels. So it can filter through, but the problem is it very rarely does, because it also hangs out in chains. So it will very rarely go through sideways effectively. But, you know, membrane filtration at 0.45 is not normally recommended for premium type of...
You take too much of the wine out.
Yeah, you do. I mean, there are different views on filtration, and this probably isn't the time to talk about it, but I'm quite positive about filtration on the basis that stability is all important. You know, too many very expensive wines are bottled unfiltered, and this leads to potentially further down the line sulfides, excessive volatile phenols, because the wine is unstable at bottling, and I think the customer deserves a stable product. So what I'm suggesting is that volatile phenols can be a good thing in wine in certain styles, as long as the wine is filtered accordingly. I'm not suggesting 0.45. You know, pad filtration is a very effective means of taking Brettanomyces out of solution, so that you are bottling a stable product. In addition, egg white fining is very effective at taking out Brettanomyces. Absolutely. You know, this trend towards no filtration, no fining, no filtration, I think is a major concern for the industry. And I think you'll find nowadays in Napa Valley, where they're the greatest supporters of the no fining, no filtration approach, even the top producers are moving towards filtration and fining to some level, because, you know, they've had too many problems in the past with wine being rejected or sent back to them for being faulty.
Okay, just finishing up before we close this out. We touched on earlier, I asked whether Brett was a good thing or a bad thing. Do you want to just give us a bit more on that?
Yeah, I mentioned I think Brett in certain doses, when it's in balance, is a good thing to me. Other people have different views. What's the view that is important is the view of a number of people, not just one person. So during my dissertation, when I did my dissertation, I got 20 people from the wine trade, number of masters of wines and experts, to analyze 25 of the top Syrahs from around the world, and analyze them for Brett and or volatile phenols, and then score those wines. So then the wines were ranked after the tasting, and then the wines were analyzed for volatile phenols, and then I correlated effectively the wine scores alongside the level of volatile phenols. Fascinating results, Chris. What we found is that the best wines had a level above the accepted threshold level. A volatile phenol is above the threshold level.
That's the threshold that people can detect it.
Exactly. What you then found mid sort of way down the ranking, if you like, level, the wine, most of the wines showed levels below the threshold, so the volatile phenols weren't detectable to most people. And then towards the lower part of the ranking, the worst wines in the tasting, as perceived by the judges, had excessive levels of volatile phenols. So it seems to be the group's consensus, and my panel anyway, was that a little bit is good as long as it's in balance. Too little is not bad, but, you know, it seems that volatile phenols can add that X factor, that complexity.
Yep.
But if you have too many, it's a disaster.
Excellent.
So, yeah, that's the group's consensus, not mine, but I just so happen to have a similar view.
What sort of number of wines have you got coming out of the IWC that you consider to be faulty due to excessive levels of Brett?
It's a very good question. 2006, we had just over 2% of all red wines bottled showing excessive levels of volatile phenol.
Okay, that's quite high, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And in the context of the approach we take, which is very conservative to volatile phenols, I think it's a major concern. Now, we don't know whether the bottles we're rejecting has been showing excessive volatile phenols. We don't know whether the fault is due to, as I said before, problems during alivage or problems actually after bottling. So we have to reject them, no question about it. But you could actually argue, like the Australians would, is that should you actually accept any wine that shows any level of volatile phenol. Yeah. But the fact is that we would be rejecting a huge percentage of red wines if that was the case.
And if the public like it, then you can't reject wines that people like because it doesn't tick the box of being pure and sterile.
Exactly, and that's something in this competition we strive for and judge in selecting medals in particular, and is to look for complexity. But, you know, a wine that shows fruit can be very appealing, and there's no question in the UK in particular, customers really love the fruit intensity. But, you know, we believe in diversity of wine styles here, and we believe consumers should be trading up and learning with us, you know, and complexity is king. You know, fruit-driven wines, adequate fruit-driven wines will receive an award, but they won't receive a medal. You need something a little bit more to get a medal, and that's complexity and, in particular, balance. Complexity, as we said earlier, can come from volatile phenols, but in lower levels where the fruit sits alongside the sulfides nicely.
One question I always try to get my head around is a lot of South African wines smell of burnt rubber. You know, the Pinotage in particular, but other ones. Is that a Brett or is it sulfur? What creates that burnt rubber smell? Because I've had Pinotages out in New Zealand, lovely bright fruit, none of this sort of burnt rubber sort of smell. But then you get a lot of South African ones that have that. Is that a fault or what's going on there?
Well, and we're not classifying that as a fault. I know exactly the character you're talking about, but we're not classifying that as a fault. It's not Brettanomyces. I'm not saying there aren't a lot of South African wines with Brettanomyces. As I said earlier, there are wines from all over the world that show Brettanomyces, but I think that's more of a stress issue. The vine has been stressed in the incredible heat of South Africa summer. In addition, we know there's viral issues in the vineyards down in South Africa, and when a vine has virus, it becomes weaker, you know, like a human being, and therefore it is affected greatly by adverse conditions, and that being heat, you know. So effectively the vine shuts down easier with a virus than it would otherwise, and when it shuts down, you get the fruit ripening on the vine, not due to physiological ripeness, but due to evaporation. It's purely evaporation, so you don't get the phenolics ripening alongside the sugars. You get the sugars increasing, but not the phenolic ripeness. And what that ends up with, what you end up with, is a wine that shows high alcohol potentially, but green characters. And I think what you're referring to with Pinotage in particular are these greener stress characters that I
always
see
think of
as well.
It as more of a burnt rubber smell. Sometimes it just really. Not just in Pinotage, I have noticed it in other South African wines as well. So you're saying it's more of a stress?
You're talking about a burnt rubber character. I'm talking about this very weedy, stemmy sort of green character. Now, I actually think the two are linked, believe it or not. That may sound strange, but, you know, different tasters have different vocabulary, you know, for the same compound. And I suspect this is what's going on. In addition, you know, once again, stressed vine, low nutrients, Stress yeast, sulfides. So you might find also there's a bit of the sulfide effect. Marriage with the greenness comes across as quite often a volatile phenol sort of character, but it's not, in my opinion, it's not excessive volatile phenols. It's a stress effect. And one of the reasons why you see New Zealand Pinotage showing great fruit and South African Pinotage with the heat showing this greener, you know, more sort of smoky, almost bretty sort of character.
Well, thanks very much, Sam. I think we'll wrap it up there. Cheers very much.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Sam. That pretty much finishes up our look at wine faults for a while. I know they've been a bit technical in places, and I hope to start writing up some good notes on faults in the next couple of months. So do stay tuned for that. Next week, we're going to be talking with sommelier Xavier Rousset about how to get the best from a sommelier. And finally, at last, but not least, we finish up this week's joke. At least this one's a bit more politically correct than perhaps the others. Here it goes. I used to think it was a silly affliction to drink different wines from different style glasses, but I've finally become a convert. I now definitely prefer drinking hearty macho reds from a Spider-Man glass and lighter fruity whites from a SpongeBob glass. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.